Good morning. The difference between voluntary guidelines and an ordinance could be landmark protection for Maui drinking water. We'll talk with water advocate Lucien Dene about the county proposal to safeguard wellheads. And we'll check in with news analyst Neil Conan from The Farm. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. It's Ballet Hawaii's 45th anniversary season, and its holiday Nutcracker production is reimagined in a Hawaiian historical setting. Choreographer Septime Weber is with us this morning. And for the first time, a UH cybersecurity team has earned national recognition.
That's the conversation for this Tuesday, December 13th. It'll all start right after this look at Hawaii headlines. And
good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Water safety and the safety of our drinking water supply is something we don't spend a lot of time, something we take for granted, right?
Well, so a lot of people do. There's also been so many fights that we've seen over who gets what water rightfully and how that water should be protected. And we're going to talk about that this morning. Now, Maui County may be the first in the state to legally obligate landowners to protect wellheads and safeguard drinking water. The bill creating an ordinance is waiting for the incoming county council to review, and it has been a decade in the making. If passed this time, it would be the first mandated protection in the state for current and future wells. Sierra Club board member and Maui County Board of Water Supply member and the president of Maui Tomorrow Foundation, Lucien Dene, is on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you. You know, since 1995, we've had an EPA-approved wellhead protection plan, but that was a voluntary plan. Why is it that it's taken so long to get something that is, you know, mandatory, given the fact that we say water is so important?
Well, that's a very, very good question. Hawaii is really kind of the last place that doesn't have any of the counties. Now, you know, other places have some counties, but not all counties have wellhead protection ordinances in place. I think that maybe the holdout here is that so much of the land is privately owned by large landowners who somehow don't quite understand how this benefits them.
That circle of the landowners who have the, you know, the land on which those wells would be have to be actually leased from or leased by the county. So they both have an interest in being able to protect what's there. But landowners traditionally don't like to be told what to do with their land. Is that at the heart of why this has taken so long and why it's been such a protracted fight?
I think that that is. A source water assessment was done about 3 or 4 years ago, I think 2012, maybe even 2011. That is the first step to delineating what areas actually need to be protected, because you don't just come in and say, landowner, we just need you to make sure that you don't build any gas stations, you don't build any chemical processing and storage plants, you don't build any airports or landfills or new cesspools around our wells on all your land. No. They delineate a particular zone on the land. And these are the kinds of things they're trying to avoid in those zones.
Is that well understood by the landowners, of that this is not something that's meant to be unduly restrictive, but it's meant to be able to simply protect the water that everyone depends on?
Well, I hesitate to speak whether the landowners understand. They have not been supportive of it. I'm not sure if the water department has met with landowners individually. I do know, in looking at the comparative ordinances in other states, that what we have drawn up in our source water assessment program are very, very narrow zones, long, skinny little things upslope of the wells, and they have, like, I think a 2 or 3 year and then a 10-year, sort of profile, like, we think in 10 years this is you know, the amount of zone that has to be protected, and 2 years, this is, you know, this is what might affect the well 2 years after it's installed. So it just something's not getting explained well here, because they really came out in force at the Board of Water Supply. And I, unfortunately, I was appointed to the Board of Water Supply. I had to step down because I had some health issues I needed to deal with, and I needed to work more to pay for treatment. So I didn't have time for the Board of Water Supply this round, but I was duly confirmed to the Board of Water Supply, and I've attended many of their meetings over the years, including the meetings having to do with the Wellhead Protection Plan. So I guess my off-the-cuff is I don't think there's complete understanding. And when you look at the list of things that are on the, you know, the potentials for contamination, the things that they want to, like, eliminate or, you know, not have new uses in these protection, these proposed protection zones, you know, they aren't things that happen all that often. Most of our wells are at a higher elevation. We're not building airports. We're not building landfills there. We're not doing gas stations, you know, right above a well usually, or chemical petroleum processing and storage. These are the kinds of things that are going to be prohibited in these wellhead protection zones. And the ordinance as drafted grandfathers all existing uses. So if there's an existing well and you own the property upslope of it and you have a gas station, it is grandfathered in. It is not prohibited. So it is really not a very, you know, hard hammer type of ordinance, but it does come with an overlay of zoning for these narrow zones, and that might be what is being resisted, that it's actually something that runs with the deed of the land.
Maui is changing, though, in its population. We've been watching it expand. How is that playing into the quest for water, and who should have it rightfully in this particular way, when it seems like so many more people are going to be needing to have water and clean water?
I agree completely, and I think that I think probably virtually every person on Maui would agree that the public water supply really needs the highest level of protection. We may disagree on how that needs to happen, but I think everyone agrees with the premise. It's expensive to drill wells. The county itself owns very little land that's suitable for wells, and so they need to go to the large landowners, get a potential well site at a higher elevation usually, and then work to develop this well. And then it would be a shame to have that well impacted and then need costly cleanup. So not just a shame, it would be a travesty.
And expensive.
So, yeah, we really need to keep, you know, our eyes on the prize. A clean, protected public water supply is in everybody's interest.
When we talk about things that are in everybody's interest, usually, you know, that sort of top-line discussion is where the agreement lies. And as you mentioned, as you get into the details of how that interest is going to be protected, is where everyone starts to you know, sort of nitpick and fight. But in this case, where you've been fighting on this and pushing for a decade, is there anything that you can think of in the current incarnation of this measure that might mean that it will actually move all the way through, as opposed to what we've seen happen with the stalling in the past years?
Well, we would hope. There is language in our general plan, and I served on the General Plan Advisory Committee. This is called the Maui Island Plan, and it's pretty clear. It says there's a policy on groundwater source protection. It says complete and implement the Department of Water Supply Wellhead Protection Program to protect the water quality of public and private wells. And the Department of Water Supply, to their credit, I, as a Sierra Club representative, have been attending hearings since, I think, 2002 on the proposed wellhead protection ordinance. And so they want to get this done. I'm hoping the new consul will be favorable to this. I'm not saying that the former consul wasn't. They really never got a chance to vote on the ordinance. It just, you know, kind of was reviewed by the Board of Water Supply, which was very critical of it, which actually criticized the source water assessment that the state commissioned for all four counties and said, oh, it wasn't peer-reviewed, oh, it wasn't good enough. I don't know. I heard the consultant give a presentation at one of the statewide water conferences His credentials seem quite substantial. He had done these for many, many other municipalities, and his methodologies were clearly explained. They didn't seem in any way slanted towards any, you know, going after any particular landowner or anything. It seemed good science to me.
All right.
And,
well,
so I think the new consul should be given a chance to vote up or down on this. And my guess is they probably will approve it.
We've got to leave it there for the moment, but thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity, and thanks for all you do.
Lizanne Dene is the president of the Maui Tomorrow Foundation. She's also a member of several local boards and a frequent presenter on water resource issues. The Maui County Council bill to mandate wellhead protection will be taken up by the incoming council. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:16. Coming up, a Christmas journey to the Hawaiian Kingdom in 1858. But first, your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about age. For a human to live through a full century is quite a feat, but 100 years in geologic time isn't even a fraction of the gestational period for a volcano. This morning, we're turning our attention to the youngest volcano in our island chain. For decades, it was thought to be inactive, but scientists found out otherwise in 1970, when it was revealed to be quite active indeed. It's more than 3,000 feet in height, taller than Mount St. Helens before its eruption in 1980. One scientific study found that the volcano is mantled with young and old lava flows and is actively venting hydrothermal fluids from its summit and south rift zone. Do you know the name of Hawaii's most junior geologic feature? If you can be the first to call 941-3689 with the name of that volcano, you will be the recipient of a hot HPR prize.
Hi, good morning. I'm Lisa Nakamichi from the Aloha International Piano Festival. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Universal stories, the classics that come back to us generation after generation, are endlessly adaptable, able to hang on to their essence even as settings, historical periods, even characters are changed. Ballet Hawaii's Nutcracker, reimagined in the glory days of the Hawaiian monarchy, has given new life to the Nutcracker story and revived the memory of the historical figures who've been brought into it. Septim Weber is the show's choreographer, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Septim.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So the Nutcracker, being a story that's had any number of adaptations, when you do an adaptation, I'm curious about, you kind of have to tune into the elements that are that need to be retained, the universal elements, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of a twofold process. Mm-hmm. The Nutcracker is a classic because it held in its DNA a kind of archetypical message, and it's encoded with information about beauty, about the need to retain a childlike wonderment about the world as we mm-hmm. as we grow old, about coming together during the holidays with a sense of family and sense of spirit. These things, these truths, one needs to retain while also reimagining the story in a fresh new way with some particulars, and in this case, particulars about Hawaiian history and culture and its natural wonders.
Because the Nutcracker story is in a way about kind of liberating your imagination, allowing yourself to dream. Huh?
Sure. The first part is grounded in reality in the party scene, and this mm-hmm. little girl, Clara, and the world around her. And we've set that at a particular moment in Hawaiian history in 1858. Mm-hmm. But she goes to sleep and she dreams. And in that dream, she sort of culturally free associates, as it
yeah,
were.
Yeah.
She really dreams through time and space, and there's an opportunity, therefore, to reference and celebrate kind of a beautiful mosaic of what Hawaii means to all of us, and images from that span span years.
Well, because the party scene set in a great house is a natural adaptation to Washington Place, yeah?
Sure. And as a matter of fact, in 1858, the original owner of Washington Place, Mary Dominus, mm-hmm. Whose son, John Owen Dominus, eventually married the future queen, Liliuokalani, and it became her home. She gave a Christmas party, a now historic Christmas party, and had the first recorded Christmas tree in Honolulu history, in Hawaii history.
Mm-hmm.
And we've set the party scene at that Christmas Eve party, which was very special, and she opened her doors to 100 Hawaiian children. So that party is grounded in reality. We've taken some liberties for storytelling, mm-hmm. but everything that happens at that party either really did happen or could have happened. We've extrapolated a little bit, but the Merry Monarch, David Kalakaua, is present, and the future queen, Liliuokalani, is present, as she would have been or mm-hmm. may have been.
Mm-hmm.
She went on to marry Mary Dominus' son just a couple of years later.
In the absence of historical record, you can, as you said, extrapolate with people who were alive at the time, knew each other. You can make certain valid assumptions about who might have been at such a Christmas party, right?
Absolutely. Mary Dominus was a widow, and she lived there with her son, John Owen Dominus, who at the time of the party was in his early 20s. So the conceit we developed was actually a charming one. Mary Dominus took on boarders, essentially to pay the rent. She,
mm-hmm.
American dignitaries and business people would stay at Washington Place. And there was an American diplomat that we found that had a daughter, Estrella, who was about 12 or so, and we
sort
of essentially so there's a fiction, essentially, that conceit that we based on that story, that an American diplomat comes with, he's a widower himself, and he uh-huh. comes with his daughter Clara, renamed Clara, and son Fritz, and his own father, who kind of helps to take care of the kids when he's off at work, let's say. And so essentially Washington Place is a boarding house, and there's a sense of family that these strangers develop,
mm-hmm.
as is a tradition in boarding houses all around the world.
Yeah.
People come together at the holidays, and strangers make their own family when they're traveling. And so that's a kind of charming conceit, and allowed for that central child, Clara, who comes of age and takes us on this really magical journey.
That's also a really nice Christmas message, in the sense that a lot of people find themselves at holiday time far from their actual family, so they spend time with the family. People make families wherever they are, right?
I think that's one of the messages. A second, actually, is the way that generations come together at the holidays. So many mm-hmm. times a kid is doesn't associate with their grandparents because he or she's on their device, on their mobile
right.
device or whatnot.
Sure.
And the holidays is a special moment when families, different generations of families, come together. And I really wanted that present on stage as well, and we've certainly succeeded in that, particularly with the present of the grandfather who interacts with little Fritz in such charming ways, and so that's a metaphor for what I think the audience does when they come to see Ballet Hawaii's Nutcracker. You'll have people from all generations of the same family coming together to celebrate.
And I would think that once we go into a dream, with the story. That's very liberating for you as a choreographer, because once you're dreaming, anything goes.
Oh my gosh, I've had so much fun. I mean, I was a history major in undergrad while training in classical ballet, and so I just naturally took to the research surrounding the party scene with particularly Royal Hawaii and 19th century history. But once she dreamed, we made a decision that she could dream through time. And so, you know, the Rat King has a sly reference to Captain Cook and Robert Wilcox as the Nutcracker, but also the snow scene is set on Mauna Kea with snow swirling about, and we have appearances by geckos and Nene Goose and hermit crabs and baby sea turtles, dancing orchids, dancing crown flowers, which were Queen Liliuokalani's favorite flower, and the grand pas de deux for the sugar plumeria fairy. And Act Two is set among a gorgeous tropical garden that was inspired. As we started the design process, my good friend Mary Philpotts McGrath was her garden was in full bloom with these gigantic trumpet flowers. So those appear, and there's a really gorgeous scene with the trumpet flowers. So there's really a celebration of images of Hawaii, and also, you know, I think that art's most powerful when people see themselves on stage. And I think when the curtain goes up, people will see themselves, because they'll see Hawaii and what they love about Hawaii and who they are in some way depicted in a respectful and celebratory and joyful way.
Well, Septima, I can really feel the fun you've had putting this production
it's been great.
Together.
And really, it's some hilarious, hilarious belly laughs available, too. It's rare when you go to the ballet and you get a belly laugh.
Well, it's all too welcome, isn't it?
Oh, good. Yes.
Thanks so much.
A big pleasure.
Septim Weber is the choreographer of the Nutcracker, the Ballet Hawaii production that will be presented this weekend at the Blaisdell Concert Hall, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can find details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Through colonization, several wars, and volcanic eruption, Pagan Island has managed to survive. But can it withstand the buildup of the American military? In today's Reality Check, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair continues a look at what the pivot to Asia could do to the Mariana Islands. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, this is a tiny place, and it's undergone so many. I mean, it's just been buffeted by all kinds of things, from invasions to, you know, certainly volcanic activity. What's at stake this time around with the U.S. military presence?
Well, quite a lot, particularly if you're someone who used to live on Pagan and wants to go back. There was a volcano in 1981 that forced an evacuation, although residents still visit. They're living on neighbor islands. But for them, it's home. It's where their soul lies, and they would like to have greater access. There's even a movement to homestead to get people back there permanently, maybe develop some sort of ecotourism or agriculture. The problem is the U.S. Navy has its own plans for Pagan. It wants to use it for amphibious landings. They want to train 5,000 Marines that are in Okinawa and Guam. And the beaches are ideal. They're conducive for these conditions of training. So you have this familiar, well, we've experienced it here in Hawaii, the needs of the U.S. military versus the needs of the residents. And by the way, I should just point out, this is a series that we've been doing. We will be doing all week. We actually sent Anita Hofschneider and Corey Lum to Guam and to Saipan and Tinian for this series that we call Pacific Outpost.
Chad, as you look at this, though, I mean, clearly we understand that the Department of Defense doesn't own any property on this island. So how would they be able to have access to all of this land that clearly other people want to just come home to?
Well, one possibility is Congress could actually use eminent domain and they could take it over, though there's no indication that's going to happen yet. But there's another possibility that perhaps you can balance the two. The island has a north and a south section, and the training would be on one end, and the residents could live on the other. But, you know, folks like the Environmental Protection Agency have warned of very serious potential destruction to rare coral species if these amphibious landings are conducted. So there's the environmental concern as well. The island, just like so many islands in the Marianas, still littered with ordnance dating back to World War II.
At this point, is there anything that may happen before we see the next administration?
Well, there is a lawsuit that's been filed. Earth Justice and others, David Henkin from Hawaii has been part of that. And they're trying to stop not only the live training plans on Pagan, but also Tinian. And that could develop. We shall see. It could be that they work out some sort of agreement. But there's another challenge. Just the access to Pagan is difficult. It's isolated. The weather can really limit getting out there. There's certainly nothing like direct flights or anything like that. So this is, if you will, forgive the language, a moving target. But there are people that are actively opposed. It's tough. You know, the military brings an economic element. There's people that feel loyal to the United States. On the other hand, this is their homeland, a place that they want to live and preserve and to prosper on. So how do you balance, I think, is the reality check this morning.
You got it. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Mele Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Willow. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Donald Trump says that sore loser Democrats are out to undermine his presidency with the help of the CIA. Many Democrats say that Trump only won with help from Russia and the FBI. And today, the president-elect names an oil man with extensive ties to Moscow to be his Secretary of State. Delegitimization and disinformation are the words on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan this week, and he joins us, as he does most Tuesdays, from his Macnut farm on the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
So all of this has been just arising after that report in the Washington Post last Friday that said that the CIA believes that not just the Russian intelligence tried to disrupt the election, that much we already knew, but that Moscow actively tried to help Donald Trump.
The essence of this story is that Russian intelligence hacked the emails of both the Democrats and the Republicans. They then leaked the material that would hurt Hillary Clinton to WikiLeaks, and held on to the information on the Republicans. That their intention was not just to, you know, sow doubt about the American democratic process, but to get back at an enemy, Hillary Clinton, and to help the candidate they saw as more likely to be a friend, Donald Trump.
So just to be clear, Neil, this is about that steady stream of emails published by WikiLeaks and not about any effort to manipulate election machines or vote totals.
You know, there was some concern about exactly that, but no evidence so far. So, yes, according to the Washington Post story, since corroborated by many other news outlets, this was about the emails from the Democratic National Committee that came out just before the Democratic Convention last summer, and the emails of Clinton campaign chair John Podesta that, you know, streamed out from WikiLeaks in the last weeks running up to the election. Now, you have to remember, of course, WikiLeaks denies that Russia and specifically Russian intelligence were the source of that material.
But this is, you know, really difficult to figure out what effect those emails had on the outcome.
Yeah, except, you know, obviously they didn't help the Clinton cause. They had some effect. And if this story is right, we could never know what the effect might have been of the material the Russians had on Trump and the Republicans, but did not publish. Again, the Republican National Committee denies that it was hacked. It says it was only the Democrats.
The president-elect, though, is ridiculing the idea that the Russians were responsible.
Yeah, and this is where we move from, you know, disinformation, which is the term that's used for this type of intelligence operation by the Russians, and we move on to delegitimization. Trump argues that this CIA report is part of an effort by Democrats to delegitimize his presidency before it begins, to say that he only got elected because of Russian help, when he says, yeah, hey, nobody knows who hacked those emails.
It could have been some guy in a basement in New Jersey.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard about Chris Christie. Exactly. And it's important to note here, Trump and his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, believe that the CIA is, you know, some kind of an arm of the Obama administration and the Democratic Party. He's accused them of incompetence. You know, he says these are the same guys who got it wrong on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. General Flynn believes the CIA helped him get him fired as help as when he was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency a few years ago, because they didn't want to hear what he had to say about, you know, Benghazi and ISIS and the Taliban, and specifically didn't want to hear it because it didn't fit with President Obama's reelection campaign in 2012.
Okay, so that's the Republican case for delegitimization. But the Democrats have an argument of their own. What is it?
It centers on the emails leaked by the Russians and the letter released by FBI Director James Comey a few weeks before Election Day. Now, there's no suggestion by anybody that these were in any way in concert, but between them, it was enough to tip a close election where Hillary Clinton lost three critical states by a total of 70,000 votes. You know, you combine that with the fact that her margin in the popular vote is now close to 3 million. So Democrats are arguing, you know, there's no mandate, you know, for the sweeping changes Donald Trump wants to bring in. And some will use the CIA's conclusions about Russia to label, you know, Trump as, you know, the agent of a hostile foreign power.
We're going to talk more about that in just a second. But a couple of other points first. I mean, some members of the Electoral College say they want a briefing from the CIA before they cast their votes on December 19th. That's coming up. This might change the way they cast their ballot for president, could it?
I guess, but this is 10 electors so far, way fewer than the number that would be needed to change the result, even if all of them 10 were from Trump states to begin with. Now, the Trump campaigns, this is just another example of sour grapes from Democrats. You know, first they tried recounts, and when that didn't work, now the Electoral College, all desperate efforts to change the result of an election, they say Donald Trump won fair and square.
Okay, there is another point, though. The Democrats say the FBI interfered in the election. And whether that was their intention or not, the effect was to help Donald Trump. Trump supporters say the CIA is helping Democrats. I mean, are we watching our two biggest intelligence agencies get caught up in partisan politics?
You bet. That's exactly what's happening, and it's not going to stop happening. You know, but it's important. Not all Republicans rejected the CIA or its conclusions. Senator John McCain and Lindsey Graham have both been outspoken in their support of both the CIA and its conclusions. They argue that Russia's engaged in a form of warfare against the United States. It's also important to note that while the FBI does not go as far as the CIA on Russia's intentions, this is kind of a matter of nuance. They agree Russia was responsible for the hack.
Okay, let's get back to the Democrats' depiction of Donald Trump for a second, though. Many remember the moment in the debate where Hillary Clinton called him a puppet of Vladimir Putin. Remember that?
No puppet. You're the puppet. This goes back to Trump's open admiration of Putin as a strong leader, support for Putin's policy in Syria, questions about the relevance of NATO, unwillingness or ignorance of Russian seizure of Ukrainian territory, his refusal to assign blame for the hacks. His previous campaign manager, Paul Manafort, who is still associated with him in some ways, well, Manafort worked for Russian interests in Ukraine, and just today Trump named Rex Tillerson as his nominee for Secretary of State, the head of ExxonMobil. He's had a long history with Russia and with Vladimir Putin. It is hard to imagine a Secretary of State the Russians would be happier with. So Democrats say just look at the results. Putin got exactly what he wanted.
There are also questions, though, about when this information came out. The Washington Post story said the Obama administration and the CIA didn't want to be perceived as using intelligence information to skew the election. Or did they just sit on the story for fear of being seen as partisan?
It's not exactly clear when the CIA reached that firm conclusion on Russian intent to help Trump. They did say during the campaign that Russia was behind the hacks. In September, according to the Washington Post story, the administration gathered a bipartisan group of senators and congressmen, what's known as the Group of 12. That's the congressional leadership from both parties and the chairs and ranking members of the intelligence committees. They were briefed on the hacks and about concerns about, you know, possible efforts to hack the voting machines to manipulate the actual results. Again, no evidence that that actually happened, but concerned that it might happen back in September. According to the Post, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he did not agree with the assessment. He blocked the idea of going forward as a bipartisan group of 12 and said he would denounce any release of this information as partisan politics, but nothing happened.
Okay, we got to go in just a second here, but obviously the president and the CIA could have decided to go public anyway.
And they didn't. They've not said why. But, you know, this was before the Comey letter came out. The CIA might well have concluded that it was inappropriate to inject intelligence into the campaign, you know, without bipartisan support.
But now Senator Mitch McConnell supports the investigation into Russia's role in the election. That puts him and other Senate Republicans at odds with the president-elect, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, a little, and maybe. You know, I have to see. McConnell did not support a special investigation, a select committee, which is what Democrats and some Republicans wanted. So you're going to have to see how far he lets that investigation go. Also, with the hearings about the confirmation, of Rex Tillerson, and President Obama, remember, has ordered the intelligence agencies to give him a report on what happened before he leaves office.
Oh, there's just so much more to talk about, but we have to go. Yeah. We'll have to hit Taiwan, China, and all kinds of other things next week. Thanks, Neil.
You bet, Beth Ann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm, and you can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. In putting together this series, a few themes are constant. They run through each program like a thread, binding it to the previous show. One of these is, you don't have to be a wealthy person to help. Most folks doing the heavy lifting are just like you and me. They work, take care of their families, create homes, and sit in traffic with everybody else. Mr. and Mrs. Fia are classic examples. They were both raised in humble homes and were among the first in their families to attend college. Today, they are both educators, raising two boys and saving for their college tuition. Now, you know educators here in Hawaii are not well remunerated. So the Fias are not loaded with money, but they are rich in a much more substantial way, for they set up a legacy fund with the Hawaii Community Foundation, which will benefit many people long after they've both passed. Knowing they're doing something to help future generations is highly enriching. The reward? Priceless. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
And now we're going to get back to today's backyard quiz. Earlier in the show, we asked you to name Hawaii's youngest volcano. It might surprise you to learn that it was only discovered in 1970. Which island had an active volcano that went unnoticed for so long? Well, actually, that's a trick question. The volcanic mountain we're thinking of is actually still underwater. The summit is located approximately 25 miles southeast of Pahala on Hawaii Island. Like Kilauea, it sits on the flank of Mauna Loa, which is also an active volcano, albeit an older and larger one. In 1970, an expedition investigating seismic activity in the area revealed that this part of it was very much alive. The conclusion was confirmed 16 years later when the underwater mountain erupted. The volcanic activity has continued on and off to this day, and Lo'ihi, which is today's answer, currently stands at a height of 3,000 feet above the surrounding sea floor.
And Beth Ann Brian Shiro, who is appropriately enough from Volcano, knew the answer to that.
And we'll be receiving an HPR prize. It's now 8:47.
Ten years ago, few of us knew what cybersecurity was. Now, we can't afford not to. As we hear about possible Russian intervention in the recent election, or about the national security agencies hacking into our phone and internet conversations, we find ourselves needing to know a great deal more about the way private information is disseminated and protected. Jason Hayworth is a team captain for the Hawaii Advanced Technology Society, a team of cybersecurity students from UH West Oahu and Honolulu Community College that has just won a national award. And Jason's with us in our studio. Good morning, Jason.
Morning, guys. Thank you for having me on the air.
Sure. Over the last decade, couple of decades, we've been asked to contribute things like our banking information, lots of personal information, to various sites that promise us security. That has turned out to be a false promise in a great many cases, yeah?
In many cases, it has. And a lot of that's due to bad system administrators and people who don't really patch their systems or go through their appropriate steps to secure the data in all forms of transit, processing, and storage. So they're not really focusing on how to protect consumer safety in many cases.
And yet we've heard stories of, you know, agencies that should know better, including the Pentagon, that have been hacked. So you wonder if the hackers aren't always a step ahead of the protectors.
So in many cases, the hackers are a step ahead of the protectors. But the biggest factor comes down to human error in a lot of different cases, is that the biggest element in computer security, if you take out the human, computers are relatively secure, but humans make mistakes all the time. And that's where we end up getting these vulnerabilities from. And that's how systems get hacked. That's how data breaches happen. And that's how stolen information comes about.
Somebody forgot to do something. Somebody put in information that should in the wrong place, that kind of thing.
Yeah, very true. Our weak passwords and things like that, right? So we always have to teach people about password security. And even in 2016, we still have to inform people as to why your passwords need to be secure.
If your password is your birthday and it's on everything you've got, you're vulnerable.
Yeah, definitely. One of the biggest things that they do within the National Cyber League is that they actually teach us how to crack passwords, right? So we take down the cryptographic hash of your password. Basically, it's kind of a random mumbling of data. And then from there, we learn how to break that and get your raw password back. The easier password is, the easier it is for us to get that information back.
But even complex ones are hackable by doing that, right?
Yeah, but it takes a lot of time and computing power. But realistically, they're not. As long as you're in the plus 12 range with special characters, uppercase, lowercase, numbers, letters, and a different variety of things, you're really pretty secure.
In a competition like the one that you folks just won, and you won against a great many other experts from around the country, what kind of things do they ask you to do? What does it take to win a competition like that?
So it goes across the board, right? We go from wireless access, breaking into WPA2, WEP, and different protocols such like that. And then we also do enumeration and exploitation. So we take programs that people think are secure, and then from there we figure out how to break them. And then get the data behind that. And we also do stuff like network web attacks, things like database injections, where we pull down records and files to figure out what's actually going on the back-end database.
Let me go back to enumeration exploitation.
So enumeration and exploitation is just a silly word for breaking into programs.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the enumeration side of that?
Enumeration as well is kind of figuring out what's on the network. So we're going to look at the targets and we're going to figure out what accesses and what services it has on the device and what type of programs it's running. And then from there, we'll figure out what type of vulnerabilities it may have.
So presumably it's kind of set a thief to catch a thief, right? If you know how things are hacked, if you know the techniques of hacking, you can protect against them. Is that kind of the principle at work here?
That is kind of the principle that they try to teach us, and that's also something called a honeypot. So within the computer science environment and then cybersecurity, what we have are these devices called honeypots. What they're basically set up to do is they're designed to mimic a vulnerable device, so that way we can figure out where the attackers are coming from and then look at what type of attacks they're sending at our devices. And then from there, we can create mitigations or plans to kind of prevent those type of accesses.
So a honeypot masquerades as somebody's poorly protected computer.
Correct.
And then you see it's the same term as it's used in the spy world, right?
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
create an attractive nuisance and see who comes to take advantage of it.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting to watch. What we do in our labs at school is we'll set up Amazon Web Service, and then from there we'll load up just an open source honeypot kind of server, and then see where these attacks are coming from across the nation, across the world.
And you find that there are plenty of them, right?
I think over the course of a 24-hour period, there was about 170 attacks on our server. So it was kind of interesting.
Who's doing this, and what do they gain from it?
So they're trying to get a lot of business information. Anything that's proprietary, anything that's worth of value, whether it's credit cards from consumers, whether it's intellectual property of your businesses, anything along those lines, they're trying to see if they can gain access to it, or they're trying to get access to your boxes to attach them to a botnet for their own purposes.
it seems to me, from a layman's perspective, Jason, that the technology has really outpaced our capacity to protect ourselves.
In some cases, it does. I think there's a lot of software out there that's being written. There's a lot of new technology that's being developed and really growing that we're not really in control of. So the entire idea of secure software programming isn't something that's taught rigorously for the past 40 years, right? It's something that's just being introduced into its life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really starting to learn is, okay, how do we write secure software? How do we make sure that it's secure for our users and then the consumers who end up being affected?
Because it has really changed the whole climate of intellectual property, of privacy, of information. A lot of that is still, you know, on a day-to-day basis, it's still pretty vulnerable.
It's almost actually gone in many cases, right? You look at, like, Target Breach, you look at these major breaches that happen, so many data records that have been leaked, it's hard to really say that you have any privacy at this point.
Well, that's a troubling conclusion, Jason.
Sorry.
If it's true, we want to know about it. I mean, obviously, and that's it certainly is true from your perspective, yeah?
At least from my perspective, yes. And then you get into just different things within social media, privacy settings that people aren't really sure about. But that's a whole other topic in and of itself.
Well, how do you protect yourself?
I just don't use it.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't have any Twitter. I don't have I do have a Facebook. It has no photo on it. But other than that, I try my best to keep away from that kind of stuff.
That's a pretty interesting conclusion to come to. Thanks very much for coming in and telling us about that.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Jason Hayworth is a team captain for the Hawaii Advanced Technology Society, a team of cybersecurity students from UH West Oahu and Honolulu Community College. The team has just won a National Cyber League competition, the first team from Hawaii to do so.
May have heard that our Radio Flyers campaign lifted off yesterday, and as of right now, we have $6,840 to go to make our first matching gift of $10,000 from Dr. Tom Kosasa. Right now, your year-end donation could be doubled and then multiplied again when we transfer 10 Hawaiian miles for every dollar to Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children's Family Fund. Now, those miles will help to fly neighbor island families to and from Honolulu so that they can be with their hospitalized young child. You can donate online at hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can call us at 808-955-8821 before the end of the day. You'll be making a lot of spirits brighter, including your own. Again, donations of any amount are welcome on the HPR website, or you can let us help you by calling our Honolulu office at 808-955-8821. And thanks so much.
Well, Beth Ann, we just heard from a cybersecurity expert that he doesn't go on Facebook or Twitter or do any of that stuff.
Well, he's got an account, but he doesn't have a picture on there, and he doesn't do Twitter. He doesn't do a lot of the other things that most media people are instructed they need to do.
Yeah, it's kind of makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I'm not going to tell you what I'm thinking about, but that's going to do it for us for this Tuesday. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Hina Mauka's Alan Johnson will give us a deeper look into the Historical Surgeon General's report on alcohol, drugs, and health, and what it means for Hawaii.
And we'll get an insider's view of the fine art of video editing. We'd like to hear from you. You can reach us via our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Or you can always post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or just want to hear something else again, or if you want a past show, all of that is on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics, too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning with more of the Conversation. See you then.